Good morning. I will call the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. The first order of business today is approval of the minutes from February 27th. And do we have Mendez? This one's right? Okay. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Same sign. Nay. All right. The minutes are approved. We're reversing order a little bit this morning, folks, because Representative Torkelson couldn't be with us to present his bill. And so Representative West is pinch hitting for him today. So we're going to take up House File 550 first. And the motion would be that House File 550 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. And so, Representative West, we have the bill before us. Go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 550 creates a bipartisan redistricting commission and submits it to the voters for approval for our next redistricting cycle. I served on the redistricting committee, and it was one of the largest waste of times I've ever had in my entire life. The legislature has proven itself less than competent to get a map through. Every single map of my lifetime has gone to the courts. Well, I think those maps have been fair. The problem with sending it to the courts is the massive expense. It's an endless stream of litigation and expensive costs for the parties involved. If we want to change the process, this bill is the avenue to do so. It has bipartisan support. It engages the legislature fairly. It ensures both political parties don't have to worry about hiring people to represent them because they get to choose the representatives that are working to put a map together. If we do want to address this issue, I believe House File 550 is the only way we're going to do it, at least this session. And I would think it's appropriate in our very close legislature, both in the House, Senate. It's a good time to come together and resolve this redistricting issue the best we can. I assume most of the bill is not within the jurisdiction of the committee, only a small section, but I'm happy to talk about all of it or just a small section, whatever the chair wishes.
Thank you, Representative West. Let's just address the issues before this committee in the interest of time. And are there member questions? Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've sort of highlighted the sections that pertain to this committee, but maybe if you could just point out to us what you consider to be pertaining to this committee. I have a few things highlighted, but if you could let us know that, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. I'm going to defer to House research on that so that everything is covered. Is that you, Mr. Hopkins? Perfect, thanks. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, at 7.18 to 7.24 of the bill, the commission is subject to Chapter 13 and Chapter 13D, the open meetings law. So that subdivision is the main purview of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. That's a pretty narrow strike zone for today, Representative West. Member questions on that section of the bill, basically just making this newly formed commission subject to Chapter 13 and the open meeting law. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative West, I don't know if the bill, correct me if I'm wrong, but the bill doesn't really talk about what happens if the commission does not reach an agreement on the maps, does it? And so, I mean, the court, it's kind of not in maybe in the four corners of the bill, but very much in the four corners of this committee, what the court's role would be. So could you address that?
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it certainly could end up in court again. Also, there is a provision where members can eject a member of the committee if the commission finds somebody who is particularly unworkable. But it is not a perfect solution, but it is certainly better than what we have now.
Representative Lieberling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not so sure about that, Representative West. I might disagree with you on that, but there also have been other other proposals, and I'm a little concerned that, you know, calling it bipartisan or having it have members from both parties on it, you know, does not make it a good or workable thing, as I'm sure you would say. You made a comment about the cost to the parties of doing it the way we currently do it, and I'm just wondering if you have actual data on that. I have no idea what the cost has been for, you know, obviously people have to hire attorneys and there's been the court process and all of that, but when you're referring to the cost, are you thinking about the whatever it costs to run a committee in addition to the litigation costs, or what were you referring to?
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Yeah, litigation costs as well. There are, there was a fiscal note on this, which I believe is not in the purview here, but all the costs are deferred until assuming that the voters pass or don't pass this, but I believe it would be a more economical option. I don't have numbers for you on the precise cost of anything.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And well, if the courts have a role, it should have a fiscal note that does come to this committee. So I would just say that for starters. And clearly the courts would have a role here. So, and whether it would be a cost or savings, it would still be reflected in the fiscal note, I would hope, and would come to this committee. So I disagree with that characterization. I would also say that in the past there have been proposals that I was aware of were for a nonpartisan redistricting committee or commission or something like that. And I think, notwithstanding that open meeting is the only maybe thing that the chair believes is in the purview of this committee, I think that this is clearly constitutional amendment, changing the Minnesota Constitution, and you know, whether this would be something that would improve the process for the state or not, I think is very much an open question. I frankly, I'm a little bit troubled by this bill. I haven't had a lot of time to dig into the details, but personally, I don't support this proposal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And Mr. Hopkins with House staff just informed me that also applicable to our committee, and it does speak to the courts, Representative Liebling is 3.4 to 3.16. And I'm going to call on Mr. Walls with House Fiscal because I believe he might have the fiscal note there that would address some of the questions that Representative Liebling has.
Madam Chair, members, I do have the fiscal note in front of me. I do have the fiscal note in front of me, but I'm. Could you repeat the specific question?
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Walls, the question is whether this has an impact on the courts, and if so, what is it?
Mr. Walls.
Madam Chair and members, the fiscal note was responded to by the Supreme Court, and they put in a cost of zero, that the cost to them would be immaterial.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative West, any comments? And then we do have a couple of testifiers.
We can go to testifiers.
Okay, perfect. The first testifier is Tom Wesson. Wesson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Tom Wesson. I'm a resident of Matamidi. I'm not an attorney or any kind of law expert, which is why I'm incredibly perplexed at the in-your-face, out-loud conflict of interest screaming from the pages of HF 550 continues to fall on deaf ears. The redistricting process and the committee needs to have the hard requirement to be as impartial as possible. The Cambridge Academic Content Dictionary defines a conflict of interest as a situation in which someone's private interests are opposed to that person's responsibilities and to other people. I'm finding it very frustrating that I have to teach this, the idea of what a conflict of interest is to elected legislators, given that this bill has passed two committees already to get here. This bill requires an 8-member redistricting committee that's selected by the 4 most partisan members of government who have the most to gain from rigging elections. This is an obvious conflict of interest that if proposed in any other domain would be prohibited. Bipartisan has become the universal criteria for a magical legislative panacea demonstrated by its 15 appearances in this bill. It's an obvious attempt to create the illusion of an impartial and fair process when in fact it's the opposite. Bipartisan is partisan, and it's the opposite of impartial. Only nonpartisan has the potential for being impartial. Creating fair and competitive districts requires impartiality and transparency. HF 550 provides neither. If you intend to vote yes on HF 550, I want to hear you defend the conflict of interest that's foundational in this bill. I want to hear you defend that embedding a permanent, untested process in the Constitution. I want to hear you defend that listing political parties as authority figures in our Constitution, a document that's supposed to be of, by, and for the people, not of, by, and for the party. If you actually believe in this bill, I would like to hear you defend these 3 elements. Otherwise, I expect you to vote no.
Sorry. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record. If you're affiliated with any organization, please state that, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul Huffman. I'm the Election and Redistricting Policy Coordinator for League of Women Voters Minnesota, where I am a volunteer unpaid staff member. I've been involved in redistricting for at least 6 years, working with local, state, and national groups on engaging and educating groups and communities on redistricting and participating in that process. I will focus on to the chair's comment on the portions of this that are relevant to this committee. In respect to hearings, while the bill states there will be open hearings and adhere to open hearing logs and state that there will be hearings established, it doesn't specify how many hearings, what locations are, what the manner of hearings will be. And that is a significant impediment to the participation of one of the major stakeholders in this process, which is the voters. The voters are the ones who are voting on the representatives, all of you sitting here in this room, and the maps will determine who they have the opportunity to vote for. The composition of this commission being composed of people appointed by legislative leaders, not excluding party officials or party consultants, lobbyists, ensures, and I think the author stated, that the parties will draw the maps. The parties are not being represented, the voters are. So we encourage you to think about the voters in this and what mechanisms are in place to ensure the voters' interests are being represented. With regards to the court's role, the court is the last resort, as stated in the bill. However, you know, in one of the early hearings, the author was asked, well, what happens if the commission doesn't agree? And he said, well, I don't know. Well, what's likely is if you look at other states with similar commissions, New York and Virginia being good examples, with closely divided electorates, those commissions deadlock. What happens is those commissions see no advantage in their agreeing to maps with the other party. If you look at the history of Minnesota, Minnesota has not had a set of maps approved by both parties since 1981, and that was a single map. That was a congressional map in 1981. So there's no evidence that the parties will agree on maps, so it should be expected that these maps will go to the court to decide on. So for that purpose, there should be a date and should be specific in the bill when and how that decision will go to the courts. The risk is that this will play out so that the courts will be left waiting for this commission to do its work and then create a crisis with meeting existing statutory deadlines for creating redistricting maps for the electoral process. Finally, the principles that were encompassed in this bill are not consistent with the most recent principles that the state Supreme Court and the special redistricting panel established for conducting redistricting. They were much more clear on considering the rights of, for example, Native American communities with considering communities of interest. And again, it's the voters that are being represented, not geographic areas and not political interests. So we ask you to think about the role of the courts, the likely outcome, and think about one of the major stakeholders, which is nowhere in this bill, which is the voters. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. I do see, though, on sections on page 7, 7.25, that the commission must adopt a schedule of public meetings and necessary hearing and administrative procedures to guide the conduct of its work, and the schedule and procedures must be posted on the commission's website. So at least for the first part of that testimony, it does seem like there is transparency as to adopting those rules of conduct and then posting the all of the meetings publicly. Representative West, any rebuttal to that? And then I'll go to Representative Curran.
Are there any more testifiers?
No, that's it.
To address some of the concerns brought up, which are valid concerns. Voter interests, these individuals that will be on this commission are appointed by people who are elected to office. They have a strong interest, I think we all do, because they would be appointed by the leaders that we elect, have a strong interest in representing the voters. And currently, to address the conflict of interest statement, current law is the legislature does this. So, that's already current law. There is no new clandestine evil conflict of interest going on within this bill. And if to the principal's question, if you look at the principles in the bill, I think they are incredibly reasonable. The compactness and continuity are leading it off, as they generally are. Minority representation is also high up there. So these, I would say, these principles are well within the norms.
Thank you, Representative West. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And I want to thank the testifier, who's happens to be just a neighbor in Matamidi, for coming up and pointing out that redistricting is an area that we have to tread very, very carefully on. And I'm glad that we're talking about it, because I do think there's work to be done. I think we can all agree that there's work to be done there. A couple of issues I just want to bring up. I have a little bit of trouble hearing and talking about this bill itself as a bipartisan bill. Just pointing out, I looked up, you know, how many authors we've got on this bill, if there's, you know, a massive support. There's two GOP House authors and one author in the Senate who happens to be part of the large DFL tent with no other supporters whatsoever on the Senate. So just when we're talking about bipartisan bills, I want to paint that picture for everybody listening. But to the testifier's point, I think we also have to be very careful about putting partisan politics into legislation. So many folks in all of our districts don't fall into a Democrat or Republican bucket, and I worry about the folks who largely represent, I think, the average Minnesotan, who is somewhere in the middle between the two, and I'm really hesitant to adopt language that sort of on its face just recognizes that two different political parties exist, and I don't know that that's how Minnesotans themselves feel. So I'd be more inclined to support a bill that is more nonpartisan, allowing for more competition among other potential political parties that may come into play. So just some thoughts there, but I am glad to see, under the purview of this committee, I'm glad to see the transparency, because clearly in this area, we want to be as transparent to the public as possible. That's what they're asking for, and that's what we should give them. So I do appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Curran. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question about what's not in our purview, but it will relate to what is in our purview. I'm just curious, when looking at the members and the appointees, and you know, and I haven't heard this bill in the other committees, like, who do the authors imagine those people being? Like, I just don't know the citizens. Like, who are the experts? They're not electeds. They're not public officials. But I'm just curious, who do you want on it?
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke, for the question. My imagination is pretty interesting, but it'd be hard to speculate on who these individuals would select. This wouldn't happen until 2030, and they could be very different people in all these positions, which I think would lead to a different outcome of the selections.
Representative Finke.
Thank you. I appreciate that, right? I have the same imagination issue, right? Like, I don't know who we're talking about. I don't know what they know about redistricting. Presumably, they will be party members. That's the point of this it's bipartisan, right? Two parties are going to pick people who represent their sides. And the thing that, I guess the bigger concern I have about this, and I know that I'm a legislator, so I'm sort of coming at us, but like, I worry that this might look a little bit like conference committee public hearings, right? Conference committees meet in public, but we all know the work does not happen in those committees, right? We're going to have people who understand politics operating outside of the purview of any public observation and then coming together for open hearings that reveal nothing. I don't like that we do it that way in our conference committees, and I would hate for us to do it that way with the entire state's redistricting. So that's just a concern I have, and I appreciate being able to air it.
Sounds good. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to address one part of that, which I completely agree about. I can't believe we have an exception on conference committees on voiding when it gets close to the end of session. Ridiculous. If you want to work on making conference committees more transparent, I think that's something we can agree on. One thing to note in this bill is they are banned from communicating with interested parties, whereas conference committees, the individual members are not banned from. So they are way easier to do their shenanigans, which we should address, not in this bill, but I believe that section helps avoid that kind of thing. So maybe they would do it, but they would be in violation of the law.
Thank you, Representative West. Any other member questions? Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to my colleagues across the aisle. I think this is actually a really substantive debate. Taking a look at the conflicts of interest piece, and I think our testifier, he was justified in saying, look, bipartisan doesn't equate to a bunch of people that are appointed by the most partisan actors within the legislature. But nonetheless, everybody has opinions. Everybody has biases, right? One idea that I was kind of jumping around in my head here, what if we had this with no lobbyist registration number, never have run for office, or we had it as a slate in the House to be confirmed by the Senate. I think that would give the public some input. They'd be able to look at the members of this bipartisan or nonpartisan or whatever you want to call it coalition and make sure that these aren't political actors. Because what I don't want to see is a bunch of lobbyists or folks who do have a vested interest in one way or the other all of a sudden basically sparring it out behind closed doors in the name of bipartisanship. And I think that you're trying to address that with this bill. I genuinely believe that. I'm just curious if you'd be open to talking offline about some of the provisions and some of the conflicts that are currently highlighted versus what could be highlighted in a future amendment.
Representative West.
I have learned it is safe to never annoy the chair of Ways and Means. So I will make no commitments on his behalf, but I, like, personally, I think your arguments have some merit.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative West, thank you for being here tonight. Since you're not Representative Torkelson, you may not be able to answer this question, but I'll ask, and you may have some insight. Do you know if the author of this legislation is working with Rep. Claiborne or Rep. Long, who had carried bills similar to around redistricting in the last session? And the reason I raise that is because I heard some of the conversation that was had. Now we had a citizen come up kind of expressed some concerns, then you noted that currently the way it is a very partisan way, the way it's done now, it requires bipartisan agreement, but it's just the legislators working on that, which is the frustration that many Minnesotans have is with that process and the fact that the courts have actually done it the last 50 years, the last five times we've done this. So I think the best path forward would be that they're having those conversations to work collaboratively to get this together. So my question is, are those conversations being had?
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for your question. I'm not aware of the conversations the author of the bill has had, but I would say anything that is going to pass is going to require bipartisan support. So my hope is if this is going to become law, we will need support from both sides of the aisle.
Representative Frazier, follow up? Good, okay. Any other member questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 550 be re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign.
No.
The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative West, for pinch-hitting for Chair Torkelson.
You have a lovely committee, Madam Chair.
Okay, so our next bill on the agenda is House File 1202. Representative Duran, welcome to your first, is this your first bill hearing?
It is.
All right. We'll try to be gentle with you, but, I can't promise anything. But would you like to move your bill?
I move House File 1202 be recommended to the and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance and Policy.
Perfect. Thank you. Go ahead with your testimony. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Today I would like to present to you House File 1202, a bill that requires interagency group meetings making recommendations, permitting decisions to follow existing open meeting laws. We have heard multiple times in this committee that we support transparency and trustworthiness in our government agencies. State agencies play a significant role in shaping Minnesotans' environmental policies. This is particularly true when it comes to permitting decisions that impact our air, water, and land quality. Ensuring these meetings are open to the public promotes transparency and enhances accountability and allows Minnesotans to better understand and engage with permitting process. This bill does not override existing legal protections related to confidential or sensitive information. Knowing this as having a drastic impact on Minnesotans, having an open meeting provides public and stakeholders with insight to work out those complex considerations behind permitting decisions. This bill ensures that when agencies collaborate on permitting recommendations, their discussions are accessible to the public beyond what is typically covered in the formal public comment period. This bill does not create a new regulatory process. It simply ensures that existing open meeting laws when agencies collaborate. Permits issued by one agency are often on or influence decisions from another. Because these decisions are interconnected and agencies work together, public access on these discussions allow for better understanding of how agencies weigh different factors and how agencies' decisions might impact another. This bill makes clear that when multiple agencies collaborate, the process remains open and accessible. In order to gain trust within the government, I feel it is vital that Minnesotans not only have opportunity for input, but also a clear understanding of how decisions are made. This bill does not change the substance of the decision-making process. It only ensures that the process is open to the public. As I understand right now, individual agencies are already required to follow open meeting laws. However, there is no standard for when two or more agencies collaborate on permitting decisions. The bill that is being presented before us today establishes a clear, consistent framework ensuring interagency discussions are just as transparent as the decisions made by single agencies. again, building trust and transparency within our government. In addition to the required documentation of these meetings, it creates a permanent record of how permitting decisions are designed. This is crucial for public review, legal challenges, and future decision making. Open meetings serve as an important educational tool for communities, ensuring no one is left out of the critical discussions. House File 1202 ensures that when agencies collaborate, the public isn't left in the dark. It provides clarity on agencies' roles and responsibilities. This would allow for Minnesotans to know who to turn to with questions and concerns regarding permitting decisions. By applying existing open meeting laws to interagency discussions, we promote government transparency, build public trust, and ultimately lead to better informed decisions to serve better interests for all Minnesotans. Thank you for this opportunity to present this bill today, and I will stand for some questions.
Thank you, Representative. I do believe you have an author's amendment, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, do you want to tell us about that amendment? It's the, folks, it's the A1, and you can move that amendment while you're at it, if you'd like to.
I would like to move that amendment, and this amendment is going to clarify on the technology part of it, so it's a technical clarification on the bill that is in regards to bringing the language and the technology piece to the bill language.
Okay, so. Perfect. So the A1 is before us, members. Any discussion on the A1? Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Just a question. I noticed that the amendment makes the bill effective the day following final enactment. Could you just explain why? Why you're doing that?
Representative.
The quicker we can get transparency to our agencies, the better it is, I believe, for Minnesotans.
Representative Lee. Hard to argue with that, right?
Madam Chair, thanks. I mean, by that sort of reasoning, we should just do that for everything, I guess. But, I mean, there's, built into law, there's some times when bills become effective, and it's sort of a, I don't know exactly why we do it that way, but I suspect it's for some predictability for agencies, so everybody kind of gets a chance to find out what is applied to them and be able to comply. You know, if we have things, you know, become effective immediately, you know, usually there's a particular reason why we do that. There's some urgency to something. Anyway, that's fine. I just thought I'd ask.
I look at the underlying bill, and on 3.3, it says this section is effective the day following final enactment. So I guess that new section, or that section with the changes, is consistent with the entire bill. So, all right. All those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Member questions to the bill. Oh, do we have a testifier? I'm sorry, we do. We have a couple of testifiers. I'm sorry. Randall Donine is our first testifier. Thank you for being with us this morning. If you want to introduce yourself, tell us who you're with, if you're with an entity, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Randall Donine. I'm representing the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. Transparency and governmental decision-making is very important. DNR takes several steps to ensure this, including public comment periods, posting information on our websites about very projects, and also providing project updates using the Gov delivery system. We have identified several concerns with this project that may make our inability to make permit decisions in a timely and effective manner. The scope of interagency groups meeting to discuss permit decisions is very broad. Many times there's formal meetings between agencies to discuss a specific application. And in other instances, it's just phone calls or more informal conversations. This bill would appear to encompass all of that. And so having to develop a process of open meeting just to have conversations would be very difficult for us to implement. The there, you know, the time and resources will be increased. Public engagement does take additional time and energy, and we are working on a fiscal note to provide on this aspect. We would be glad to work with the author on this bill to find an enhancement of public transparency that can be effectively implemented within our agencies.
The next testifier is Tom Johnson. So if you want to introduce yourself, who you're with for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'll start by echoing the Department of Natural Resources and assure the committee that the MPCA takes transparency very seriously. Over the past couple of years, there's also been additional investments from the legislature in increasing transparency at the MPCA in its permitting decisions. A couple examples, one would be our community affairs team that was stood up just in the past year from investments that were made in 2023 and 2024. And so that team assures that the community is kept up to date and any of the interested parties in the area affected by the project as conversations go along in the permitting process. So that's been a major development. We also have a permit application tracker now, an online tool that allows folks to see in real time, both the public and the project proposer, see where their project is in the process. And so I appreciate the intent, and we're happy to work with the author moving forward. We do have some concerns, and several of them will be similar to what you just heard, so I'll keep it brief, Madam Chair, but the language is very broad. The MPCA, in addition to working with state agencies, also works with federal agencies, and so informal meetings with the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, or the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which we work with directly on their permitting process, oftentimes for a public body. Like a municipality may need a federal 404 wetlands permit, and we have a state process that helps inform and certify that federal process. So anyway, any of those conversations might be construed to be taken into effect here. We also have, by the bill, we also have a concern that some of these meetings may include non-public data, which would not be able to be shared in the public setting, and that might undermine the intent of opening that conversation to the public when we wouldn't then be able to share the content of that conversation. So, again, just want to end by saying I appreciate the intent of the legislation. Transparency is important, and it was helpful to hear the intent of the author, and so we're happy to continue to help working on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Duran. You're doing good. First bill. A couple questions. One, is this legislation in regards to address a specific thing that happened at some point?
There's Madam Chair. Sorry, Representative Frazier.
Yeah.
there has been some questions on whether or not the agencies are being as transparent as they could be, because there is no guidelines on this particular area when it's permitting from different agencies working together. So there has been some specific concerns that I cannot pinpoint right now, but that have been brought up in that aspect of it. Yeah.
I forgot to make this announcement when we started, but if you are in the committee room as a member of the public, we need you to be seated in a chair. And so I just wanted to make that public. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Duran. So this Statute 13 or Chapter 13 is historically the way it's been applied is when decision makers are meeting to deliberate and then make decisions. My understanding is in this bill, you're asking that folks that come together as almost as an advisory group to provide recommendations that they be subject to those same to the same criteria under Chapter 13. Can you explain why it would be important for an advisory group, someone that doesn't have decision-making power, to be subject to the open meeting law?
Yep. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier, this is going to help with a little bit more transparency when it comes to the interagencies working together on some of the decision-making that has been brought forth. And a lot of these agencies are having these discussions without properly informing the general public on some of these decisions making. So what I'm asking for is that when they come to permitting decisions, that they just open it to the public to allow the public to hear how they're making these decisions and why.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for indulging me. So to that point, Rep. Duran, are you saying right now the public is unable when the decision makers are actually meeting and they are have to comply with open meeting law and they're deliberating and they make any comments regarding advisory opinions or recommendations? Are you saying that is not enough for the public to have transparency on how they're coming to those conclusions?
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier, yes, that these permitting decisions should be based on public opinion and public hearing in order for all of us to get a good understanding of what direction they are, these agencies are going with their decision making. So we just we want to make it open, we want to make it public, we want to keep up with the government transparency and keep with the trustworthiness of these agencies. So.
All right, Representative Frazier.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Duran. Just the final question. I noticed that we're specifically targeting interagency groups, but how do we define an interagency group?
Representative Duran. I'm not sure that's in the bill. But.
It is not addressed in this bill, but there are different state agencies who do collaborate together that have these conversations again behind closed doors, as we heard that there's multiple conversations with these, but there's no definition in this bill for the interagency. So,
Representative Frazier, I can ask House staff if they have an idea of if there is anywhere in statute the definition of an interagency group. I'm not sure who that goes to. Is that you, Mr. Hopkins? Thanks.
Madam Chair and members, no, there's not any definition of interagency group elsewhere in statute. The language at 2.13 to 2.14 of the bill would be the guiding language.
All right. So it is in the bill. My apologies. It is right there. We certainly understand what you're getting at, and the public needs to know how these decisions are being made, and sometimes that's just not happening. So Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative, congratulations on your first bill. I remember being there on my first day. I continue to support sunlight. I don't have a problem with the idea that our permitting decisions would be made in public. I actually have, I don't know how many people know this, many years ago I actually worked in this field, and permitting is something that I'm very interested in as a subject. And I do think that one of the things people don't understand is that public opinion on permitting is, you know, if we're going to open up the permitting process to everyone to have an opinion about, we're going to have a lot harder time building anything in this state, which I think is really interesting. But I have two quick things I want to follow up. One of them was Representative Frazier's final point, which is that interagency group of state employees. I do think it would be good to work on putting a definition into the text of what we're talking about. I would ask, for example, if our testifier from DNR and our testifier from MPCA had a conversation about a permit application, is that an interagency group of employees? It would seem to me to be an interagency group of employees, but I can't imagine that conversation would need to be live streamed. And if it is, then we should make sure that we're clear about that. And I know we talked about, we just had a conversation about a legislative commission, right? And a legislative commission isn't the same as conversations around permitting, in that they have the number of stakeholders in these permitting process conversations is too many to count. So I would want to have some kind of construct around which what these conversations are when they are qualifying, when they are not qualifying, and what information is and is not to be made public. As our, Mr. Johnson testified, there's going to be a lot of private and corporate and financial information in these. These permits are for private companies to build things, generally speaking. And private companies have a lot of vested interest in those conversations, often not being public. And for me, it would be great if we also added a requirement that developers' conversations with these agencies also be live streamed. So there's going to be a rippling effect about what it means for us to try to define interagency group of state employees making recommendations and what that's going to include and what that's going to exclude. I'm sure that these private developers will not want their conversations as a part of this subject to open data practices. So I really do think finding out what we mean, right, because what we mean and what's in the text needs to be pretty clear, and it can really backfire on us if it doesn't satisfy everyone. So I would strongly recommend that you do some work on a definition there. But if it doesn't come together in a way that's going to satisfy the people who are actually behind those projects, then just member to member, you're going to have a lot of people upset with you. It's happened to me before, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vicky. Any reaction to that, Representative Duran?
Yes, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Vicky. About the privacy, this bill does not dictate that every conversation has to be open. It still has to fall underneath the data practice and open meeting laws, right? So this bill does not, I even said that it doesn't override any existing legal protections related to confidentiality or sensitive information. You know, this bill doesn't, affect that. It doesn't say that everything has to be open. It just says some of the decision making, that decision should be open to the public when you're making those final decisions with the permitting process. But this has nothing to do with some of the confidential conversations that is in law already. So,
Representative Finke.
Appreciate it. I just want to say back, I know that's what you're intending to do, and also that is not what the definition of this is, right? It says interagency group of state employees making recommendations regarding permitting decisions. It's far broader. Like, if this goes to court and you're interpreting that sentence, it's going to be far broader than what you just said. So this is truly, truly friendly to make sure it says exactly what you want it to say, because I don't think what you just said is what the text says. And that's as we just heard, that's the only place in the statutes of the entire Minnesota Code where that term is used. So I just would recommend taking what you, even just take what you just said and make it say that, because those two things were not the same. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I'm sure Representative Duran is willing to work on this as time goes on. Representative Rarick has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's interesting because I was going to say some of what Representative Finke was just talking about and kind of understanding kind of what's in the bucket, what's not in the bucket. That's what's really important for this bill. And I actually was going to ask the agency if they could, specifically Mr. Johnson, because he made some comments, if he could maybe clarify some things, because I'm also, Representative Finke, trying to understand what's in the bucket, what's not in the bucket. Obviously, if something is on public data, that can't be released because of Chapter 13. But I'm wondering, Mr. Johnson, if you could explain just a little bit about what you meant when you said the phone calls or kind of these smaller conversations, I'll call them, where non-public data is being discussed. Can you just expound on that just a little bit so I have an understanding as to what communications that you're talking about that would be difficult to include the public? Because I know you briefly talked about it. You talked about a phone call, and you talked about having non-public data being discussed, which, I mean, I completely understand that. We have pretty significant Chapter 13 protections for non-public data, but if you would just expound on that, please.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Rarick. So I think we're also looking for clarity at the scope here. So I think this conversation has been really helpful. But I think the kinds of situations that might be difficult would be if the permittee that we're issuing a permit for or discussing issuing a permit for might have an enforcement issue that still needs to be that corrective actions may need to be still completed. In that case, it would still be protected under DPA protections as non-public, but it might be pivotal to the issuance of the permit. So I think that would be one example. Another that might be difficult is, again, those interagency conversations that might be with a federal agency that we cannot compel by state law. So we may say, well, we have a responsibility under this new law, provision of law, to make this meeting public, and the federal agency might say no. And so we'd be stuck in a situation then where who do we comply with? So,
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That helps a little bit. And so I know the language of the bill talks about recommendations regarding permitting decisions. And so I'm assuming by your testimony then that if somebody was noncompliant, that would lead into a discussion of saying, well, we can't issue the permit because they still haven't rectified a previous noncompliance. So if I look at this whole bucket of conversation that interagencies are now having that are non-public, how much of that do you think fits into the category of, well, this is protected by Chapter 13, this is non-public data, these are, you know, really quick phone conversations just to maybe verify some information or something? How much fits into that bucket, and how much do you think fits into the true intent of the bill, which is we really want to have more transparency, which I know Representative Finke talks about a lot, and I appreciate that. So thank you for bringing up the transparency part. Because obviously, if a single agency is doing this work, there is open meeting laws. But when the complication is when we have two agencies that are doing the work together. And so I think that's what this bill is getting at. If you could just help me understand, how much do you think is in each bucket?
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I'm not sure I could speculate on how much is in one bucket. I would say there's two separate concerns here, and one is the non-public piece, which admittedly is probably a small amount of cases. I'd say the larger bucket, and I would say the grand majority of interagency meetings, if it were to include these, would be the small conversations where we're asking the Board of Water and Soil Resources about an easement or something that's, you know, or a wetland issue that they're dealing with a local government on, or we're talking to the DNR about something related to an aquatic species, right? I mean, these are really small kind of colleagues talking to each other across agencies. And so I think that's really the major concern, and may have an impact on fiscal note, would be that are all of those in the bucket, I would say. If the intent of the bill is, if there are major conversations happening about big decisions, you know, a lot of those are already subject to public data. They're all public data, and our requests are able to be requested. And so I think if there's an extension to that, to a public meeting, I think there's areas where we could explore that. But a lot of this is covered in the public notice period or in other, you know, more public conversations that we're having already, as I alluded to further. So anyway, we're willing to continue to explore whether there's an area here that's not being covered that should be, and that's, I think, what we're committing to with the author.
Perfect. And thank you, Representative Rarick, for those questions. And I do want to clear up one thing on 2.13. It does say of an interagency group of state employees making recommendations. So that would exclude the federal government, the EPA conversations, well, which may actually be important, an important piece to how the decision making happens. But that's what the bill says. And I think, Representative, and we have a couple more questions here, folks on the list to answer the questions. But I think, Representative Duran, I'd like to lay this bill over because I think there's a way of achieving what you want to achieve. I think it's just with Representative Finke and Representative O'Neill, I think there's just a way of tightening up the language and making it better so that this actually does what you think and want it to do and what we all want to happen. And I know Mr. Hopkins is excellent on these issues. There are other organizations that are great. So, but that's, I think that's what we'll do today is lay it over because I think it needs a little bit more work and then we'll have a good bill to go off of. So next on the list is Lee Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Duran. And I just wanted to really compliment you on bringing your first bill. And some of the things that have been raised are the same kind of concerns that I have as well. And I know you didn't want to say a specific reason that you're bringing the bill, but maybe I'm just imposing my, history on this, but often we bring a bill for a constituent. There's a problem in our district. Somebody asks us to solve a problem for them. And then as legislators, we try our best to do that. I have one right now, in fact, that I'm kind of struggling with how I can help the constituent because it's a real problem. But I think one of the challenge is that we have a certain set of tools here, and sometimes the solutions are much harder to arrive at than meets the eye. And I think that's kind of what you've got here, that you're trying to solve a problem. I don't know exactly for whom, but it's very admirable that you're doing that. That's why we're here, to try to help our constituents solve problems. And yet, then you get into the thicket, and you realize there's a lot there and how hard it is to change laws and do it in a way that you can get broad agreement around, which obviously right now you have to do, but also in a way that actually will play out the way you intend. So I just wanted to say that and, just appreciate your willingness to continue to work on this and take comments and input from people. And we do have a lot of expertise around here and, we're all here to solve problems. And I think it's a great effort on your part. And I'm sure we'll hear more bills from you. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Lee Liebling. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Duran, for bringing this bill. I support the underlying values of transparency. I think it's so important. And I don't think that arguments that it would be difficult are necessarily outweigh the objective of transparency. So I don't, when I hear that, it'd be kind of hard, I don't think that that's necessarily more important than ensuring that we have transparency where we need it. I do think that the definition of interagency group needs to be defined. But I also just had a random specific suggestion, and it may narrow your bill more than you want to. But when I was hearing concerns about as we're gathering information, they weren't sure about whether that should be public. If you changed on line 2.13, if you just said of an interagency group of state employees making final recommendations regarding permitting decisions of a public body, that would get to that point where they've gathered the data and they've had those conversations and they are now getting together to assess what is the economic benefit, what is the environmental impact, who are the parties, as they're having all of those considerations, that would then be public. It may narrow your bill further than you want to, but I just wanted to throw out that suggestion that if you said making final recommendations, then it would just be more clear that it's not all that preliminary legwork is these groups of people are just trying to gather the information. So I just wanted to throw that out there for you.
See how helpful we all are around this table. Final question, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Duren. Actually, Representative Feist and I were operating on the same wavelength in terms of just thinking about the tension between transparency and convenience. Transparency is inconvenient. Having served on a city council for 7 years, having to adhere to the open meetings law, it would be much more convenient if we could just all get on a conference call with each other and decide how things are going to go for the city, but we can't do that. And I think properly, we can't do that, shouldn't be able to do that. But there is a balance that's struck in the open meetings law where it doesn't prohibit me from having a conversation with the mayor as a city council member. What it prohibits is a quorum, which is empowered to actually make a decision, from getting together and having a meeting and coming to final conclusions about the way things are going to go. And so in the spirit of what Representative Feist had to say, as we're working on the language and trying to hone things down and define them, finding that sweet spot of, okay, when are we getting to the point where we're close to making a decision here? And it's going to have the maximum amount of value for the conversation that the public should be privy to. However that lands, that's a good suggestion to start from. That should be the goal. Thank you.
Representative Duran, any final comments?
I appreciate everybody's input and looking forward to working with everybody on making this bill pass through. So thank you very much.
Perfect. Thank you so much for bringing the bill to us. And House File 1202, as amended, is laid over.
We now have House File 390 for our consideration in committee. Chair Scott, would you like to make the motion to get the bill before the committee?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 390 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
And I see that you have an amendment to your bill. Chair Scott, would you like to offer the A1 amendment?
Yes, what the A1 does is it removes a citation that is not referred to in a court case that we will be talking about today, and we found that it was not necessary to have that citation in the bill.
That sounds relatively technical. Is there any member discussion on that? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please state so by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Chair Scott, would you like to present your underlying bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. So House File 390 is a bill that codifies one of Minnesota Supreme Court's data and record and records decisions by allowing data requesters to bring suits against government entities that improperly destroy official records before they are approved, before their approved destruction date. One of the structural problems in our data and records laws has been that while you could sue over a government entity's denial of access to data that the entity held, there was no clearly recognized way to sue the government if they destroyed a record that contained the data that you should have had access to. So this bill seeks to remedy that situation, and I have Mr. Elling with Minnesotans for Open Government alongside me to give it more detail.
Mr. Elling, welcome back to the committee. Introduce yourself and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Lead Liebling, Representative Scott and Chair Scott, and members. Matt Ealing, Minnesotans for Open Government. Our board members support this bill, which places a cross-reference within the Official Records Act. That cross-reference states that the private rights of action in the Data Practices Act can be used to address violations of the Official Records Act, including the improper destruction of official records. And I'll talk more in a moment about why that's important from a policy perspective. First, I want to back up and talk at a high level about our system for managing government information in Minnesota. In our packet, you'll see references to three separate laws that interact to make sure that the public knows what the government is doing, all of which play into this discussion here. The first is the Official Records Act. This was our state's original information management statute passed in 1941. It basically says the government is charged with making and preserving records necessary to an understanding of its official activities. So without this basic documentary record, no one can really know what the government is doing. Next is the records management statute, which sets out a process for deciding how long records are preserved for. And under that law, government entities have to create retention schedules specifying how long records are kept and when they can be lawfully destroyed. And this was the law that was at play during last week's discussion about correspondence retention. Finally, there's the Data Practices Act, which gives the public the legal right to access public data held within records maintained by the government and to sue for access violations. So this is where your news comes from. You'll see in today's Star Tribune a story about that was drawn from official email records that were pulled from a locality. So this is where your news comes from. All three of these laws work together to ensure that the public has access to relevant information about government work. And I want to speak to why today's bill fits into that important framework. A few years ago, a data requester named Tyler Halva brought suit against Minsky under the Data Practices Act for denial of access to public data. Halva also sued Minsky under the Official Records Act for improperly destroying data on the legal theory that the Official Records Act had an implied right of action. So basically that there was a way for an individual person to use that law to sue the government. When that matter reached the Supreme Court held that there was no private right of action in the Official Records Act itself. However, the court did recognize that the improper destruction of official records could be addressed through the existing civil remedies in the Data Practices Act. And so, in short, the court in the Halva case said that there was no need for a private right of action in the Official Records Act because the Data Practices Act could already address those kinds of violations. And so, since the Halva case, this principle has been in the common law of the state of Minnesota. This bill today, HF 390, does not change that one way or the other. It simply adds a cross-reference in the Official Records Act that lets the public know that if there's a violation, they have a remedy through the Data Practices Act. And I just want to talk briefly about why this is important as a policy matter. So last week, in the hearing on HF 428, you heard members of Minnesota's environmental community up here talking about a case involving official records and their destruction. Briefly, in the facts of that case, there was a permitting matter, which we've just heard about, discussed now, working its way through the administrative review process. And there were records that were pertinent to that administrative review process and that permitting process that were destroyed by a state agency. This was discovered during litigation over the permit itself, and the Minnesota Supreme Court, because of that destruction of official records, turned the permit back for further review. It said that there were irregularities in the procedure that required the permit to be reviewed and sent back. So that's why it's important in the environmental review context, and that's why it's important in really any context involving government activities. So to close, members, I just want to, again, place this bill within the context of other important bills that you've heard in front of this committee in the last few weeks. For Minnesota's open government framework to work, you have to have data about consequential matters available to the public so they can request it. That's what HF 20 did that you heard a few weeks ago. You have to have a standardized retention period for important records so that citizens can actually request them. That was what HF 428 talked about last week. And citizens also have to know what their remedies are, and that's what HF 390 does today by including this cross-reference. So, members, thank you for your time and attention, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Our next testifier is Rick Hellier. Is Rick Hellier in the room?
With permission, can I stand or do I need to kneel?
Traditionally, testifiers are seated.
Then I'll take that. I have to kneel. Okay. I come to testify today.
Can you please identify yourself for the record before beginning your testimony?
My name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent the print disability in Senate File 1703 this year. also unofficially represent Twice the Exceptional. Last year, Bill 3299. Come testify on this bill. The legislature has a digital accessibility policy. If anyone wants to know, you go to the bottom of the page, special needs or accessibility. Then you go to their, it's called the usability comment form. And then you go to the next link, first one on the paragraph, privacy policy. And then you go to the next link that's called retention policy. It's my firm belief if you're going to ask, if the legislature's doing it, and by the way, that was done by the Lent group. I'm not quite sure. That's not abbreviated. In 2009, that's the last time it was updated. Legislature wants to have some data practice involved there. I suggest that in the future that you're going to have these other parties to bring awareness in the statute somehow that they have a page that the legislature has dedicated for transparency regarding retention of records.
Mr. Hillier, I'm struggling to understand how your testimony is relevant to the bill that's before us.
And that relates to retention of records, sir, people. If the legislature thinks it's relevant that you post that, then put it in statute for others to post it for the public. And by the way, that's only a should to the legislature, because the legislature is exempt. There's a letter from on the Data Practice Commission from Lori Swenson dated March 17th that explicitly expresses that the legislature is exempt from data practice law and accessibility law. However, I'm excited to know, that everyone know that last year in October 15th meeting at the LCC, the Legislative Coordinating Commission created accessibility policy for the legislature. So that's two parts things, people. Transparency and digital accessibility. What would we do if we couldn't find it without searching it? And if we can search it, it can read out loud, be accessible with Braille, provides more inclusion.
Mr. Hillier, I appreciate your testimony. I'm going to have to cut you off simply because your testimony is not directly related to the scope of this bill. This bill has to do with providing a remedy for folks regarding the Official Records Act. You're speaking to accessibility of information in our legislative process, which is a totally different subject. So I'm going to move on to Mr. Hillier. Please respect the will of the chair and the committee. We're going to move on to member discussion. Are there any questions regarding this bill? Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Scott. I did have a question about whether or not this bill would be applied retroactively. I understand from Mr. Ealing's testimony that it's basically codifying what the case law says. But I guess the reason I'm wondering about, well, I'll just ask the question first, is would this apply retroactively to violations that have occurred in the past?
Thank you, Representative Moeller. This has been on the books since 2021. So from that date forward, there would be a cause of action to seek remedies through the Data Practices Act for Official Records Act violations. So my read would be that since the date that the court opinion came out, then any fact pattern that would lead to a cause of action since that time could be pursued.
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Moeller.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm not sure that it would be considered from the date of the court decision, though, and I'm just curious if maybe nonpartisan staff could let us know if this were enacted, would it apply retroactively to past violations?
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moeller, so generally laws are not given retroactive application unless the language in the legislation specifically says so, which this does not. So it should not be given retroactive application unless it specifically says so in the language.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just for clarity then, it would apply to any violations, like let's say it goes into effect August 1st, since that's typically the date laws like this, or July, I always forget, July 1st or August 1st, but it's one of those. It would then it only apply to those violations that occurred on or after July 1st or August 1st, whatever the date may be?
I believe that's a question for Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, yes. If it doesn't have retroactive application, it would apply to a violation that occurs on or after the date that the law becomes enacted.
Representative Mueller.
That's all I needed to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Scott, you have a comment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding, and Mr. Ealing can verify this or not verify it, but my understanding that is that there are people that have already brought, based on that court decision, that they're already bringing lawsuits. But if you want to clarify.
Mr. Ealing.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Mueller, and thanks to Mr. Hopkins for that piece of information. It's an interesting question, right, because you're including a cross-reference to something that's in common law already, where there's been a couple of court actions taken based on the common law. So there was a Hennepin County lawsuit where there was an Official Records Act violation pled as part of the complaint. There was a case involving a St. Paul requester who used to be on our board, actually, Bob Katnack versus the City of St. Paul, where that question came up. It wasn't part of the initial pleadings, but it was discussed in the case. So that's why I'm talking about, from the common law perspective, some of this stuff has already been dealt with in the last couple of years. From the effective act date perspective, I think that's the technically correct approach to the effective act date, but I don't think it changes the common law application of what's in common law currently.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate all of the clarification here. It's helpful. And the reason why I'm asking, I just want to make sure that if a bill like this were enacted, that it's not going way back in time for any sort of violation that may have happened in the past. I really don't want to maybe, you know, reward someone who's looking to make money off of this and trying to find any kind of violation in the past and then file lawsuits or whatever to try to profit off of that. So that was the reason why I was asking about retroactivity. Thanks.
Mr. Ealing, you have a comment?
Representative Mueller, just for further clarification about the monetary aspects of this, if you look at 1308, which is basically what the court has said, this is the remedy you have available for Official Records Act violations. There's a certain courses of action in 1308. You can apply for injunctive relief if you want to stop a government entity from destroying official records now because of the Halva decision. There is a damages provision, but it's going to be hard to seek monetary damages for even the destruction of records that should have existed. It's going to be hard. It's not impossible, but very hard to put a monetary figure on that. So most people who are pursuing remedies under the damages provision are going to be seeking to have nominal damages awarded by the court of $1 so that they can take advantage of other kinds of penalties that will be applied to the government entity for their improper records destruction. So,
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a question for Mr. Ealing. I was just curious, how often does a violation of the Official Records Act not also result in a violation of the Data Practices Act? I'm just curious of, like, the scope of the problem we're trying to address.
Mr. Ealing.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Feist. That's a very insightful question. This is something that Don Gemberling and I have talked about for a long time, even before the Halva case. In 1303, which is the data access portion of the Data Practices Act, where it talks about the requirements that apply to a government entity, what they have to do. It says you have to make your records easily accessible for convenient use, and that's also language that used to be in the Official Records Act back in 1941 that then got transferred over to the Data Practices Act in 1979. So you not only have to provide access to those pieces of data that are requested, but you have to organize your data so that you can do that. And in a instance where you destroy data, you're certainly not making it easily accessible for convenient use if you're destroying it improperly. You know, you have to destroy data according to a records retention schedule. And so that's why the court in Halva looked at that nexus between the Data Practices Act and the Official Records Act and said, look, we don't need to make this other cause of action. You've got one in the Data Practices Act. And in terms of the scope of how often this happens, we have seen more frequent problems around access to data that already exists. than data that's been improperly destroyed. It's not to say that it doesn't happen. The case that I talked about, In Re Denial, the environmental review case involving the PolyMet permit, involved destruction of records. And had they chosen this pathway, because HALVA was in effect at that point, they could have sought redress for that records destruction.
Representative Feist.
Thank you. Thanks for that answer. So is the issue just that we want to make it easier for litigants to not have to, like, backtrack and then pursue litigation under the Data Practices Act? Or can't they just bring the lawsuit based on both violations right now?
Mr. Ealing.
Representative Feist, you could currently make in your complaint references to both violations, you know, a data destruction violation under the Official Records Act and a failure to produce data under the Data Practices Act. What the cross-reference in this bill does is it basically just lets the public, when they're looking at the Official Records Act, know that, say, if you see a violation of this particular statute, here's where your remedy is.
Representative Feist.
Right. Thank you so much. So it's not so much, sorry, I'm just thinking out loud and learning out loud in front of everyone. But so the goal isn't to allow people to, like aggrieved people to show that they have been harmed because they didn't have access. It's to allow people like yourself to ensure that we're keeping the government accountable. And when you notice something, you could bring it purely under the Official Records Act, because it's not about you wanting that access. It's about the public being entitled to it.
Mr. Ealing.
Let me answer you and make sure I'm answering your question properly. The cross-reference would essentially just let members of the public who want to, who are aggrieved by the destruction of records, improper destruction of records, it would let them know where the remedy is. Because right now you have to dig through case law to understand where it is. And one thing that we've done in this state that I think is better than what the federal government has done with the FOIA law is that we have tended to put stuff in statute. And you can see it's easier for the public to get their arms around it rather than reading through a lot of case law about where it is.
Representative, you're good? Okay. Chair Scott.
Yeah, just for simplification, I think what we're getting at here is that it's codifying that HALVA case so that people have a convenient reference to what their rights are when they've been denied access to government data or when they discover that it was destroyed improperly.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, I'm looking at the nonpartisan explanation of the bill, and there's several remedies, and you referenced a few of them. Can you just talk briefly about the misdemeanor criminal penalties? You haven't touched on that. I was sort of waiting for you to talk about that as the private right of action and sort of the result.
Mr. Ealing.
Representative Rarick, I believe the amendment that came forward removed that 1309 misdemeanor penalty. Mm-hmm. There was some discussion that we had with Representative Scott about making sure that the bill actually codifies what was in the court case. So the court case refers to the private rights of action in the Data Practices Act, so that's 1308 and 13085. So 1308, you go through district court, 13085, you can go to administrative court for a faster remedy. The 1309 is an existing criminal provision where you can bring a misdemeanor charge against someone for violating the Data Practices Act. In terms of records destruction, there actually is another existing criminal penalty in Chapter 138 that makes it a misdemeanor to improperly destroy government records that are on a retention schedule. So there was already a remedy available for that, and because this wasn't cross-referenced or discussed in the court case, we thought it would be cleaner to remove that reference.
Thank you,
Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That clears it up. I was just confused, so that's why. Thank you so much.
Lead Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the good discussion on this. I also have been kind of struggling to understand what problem is being solved here. I don't think this is just codifying that case at all. I mean, the case says your remedy is with the Data Practices Act. And the Data Practices Act is where somebody has, as I understand it, it's where somebody has tried to get records. And it's a different situation. And I really appreciate Representative Feist's line of questions about this, because I'm not really sure that it is just, in fact, I don't think it's just codifying that opinion. It seems like it's giving a right of action to someone who isn't personally aggrieved or hasn't tried to get records. And it's just kind of maybe more of a watchdog function, as Representative Feist was talking about. So I think that's a little bit bigger deal than just making it clearer in the statute for somebody who's looking. And, you know, somebody who's looking is probably going to be an attorney who's looking to bring a lawsuit and really probably doesn't need that help, honestly. So I'm just a little bit troubled by this. I would like to ask Chair Scott if there is a fiscal note requested on this, and or if, what it shows, if there is one.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Chair Hudson. Representative Liebling, yes, a fiscal note has been requested.
Lead Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative Scott, I assume that if the fiscal note is not zero, it's probably going to be something in the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I'm not sure what else. But I would really like to see this bill. I'd like to see the bill go to state government, not just. I think you were sending it right to the General Register, if I'm not mistaken. And I think it needs to go a little further than that, because I think this is maybe one of those bills that appears to be like super simple, like kind of a no-brainer, but actually it may not be. And I think it's really important that we have state government where this these are official government records we're talking about, and I think it's pretty much under the purview of state government. So I'd like your response, you know, Chair Scott, before I make a motion.
Chair Scott.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Hudson and Lead Liebling, for the question. What I'd like to do is move the bill forward. I think the likelihood of a fiscal note is pretty darn low in this case, and so I'm going to stick with my original motion.
Lead Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, then I'm going to make a motion, Chair Scott, because, you know, I mean, if this is something that we can do in a bipartisan way, and if it's really kind of as simple as it appears, there shouldn't be really any problem. And, you know, there's not a huge, I don't think there's a huge time crunch on it. We could wait for the fiscal note and just see, and maybe I'm totally wrong and it just, you know, can just sail right through, no big deal, but maybe not. So I'm going to move that the bill be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
I assume you'd like a roll call.
And I would like a roll call. Thank
okay.
you.
So the motion has been made to re-refer House File 390 to the Committee on State Government. And a roll call wrote. I'm sorry. Oh, is there any discussion? Seeing none, a roll call vote has been requested, and our committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
No.
Vice Chair Hudson?
No.
Representative Bliss?
No.
Representative Corinne?
Aye.
Representative Duran?
No.
Representative Ingen? Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Finke?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Mahmoud?
Aye.
Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Representative Rarick? No. Representative Steer?
There being six ayes and seven nays, the motion does not prevail. Returning to member discussion, several issues were raised. Chair Scott, would you like to respond?
Members, I think we've had a really good discussion here, and I think that
it's not a complicated bill, and I would urge members' support.
Sounds like a close to me. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Scott renews her motion that House File 390 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and House File 390 as amended is on its way to the general register. Seeing no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.